You're listening to a topical discussion from the Talking Torah Roundtable with Yoel Halevi and Jeff Gilbert. For more episodes, you can reach Jeff at talkingtorah.org and visit us at hebrewinisrael.net.
Okay, Barakim Vanibrahim, everybody. Wish you're happy with us again for another one of our weekly roundtable discussions. Now, this week we're going to do things a little bit different just because we the portion Bechokutai is a little bit short. So we're going to include the discussion on chapter 26 of Leviticus and kind of flow right into the Hosea discussion that we've already planned for this week. So with that being said, Shalom Aleichem, Yoel. Glad to have you back with us today.
Yep, thank you for having me again. And I will point out, by the way, that according to what Jeff showed me, a lot of websites did Behal B'chukotai together, assuming that they are together this year, but they're not. And I know this is a fact, A, because I checked, B, because I went to synagogue this Shabbat, and I knew exactly what they were reading. So anyone who did both of them together basically skipped a week. But, yeah, you know, not the end of the world.
Yeah, not the end of the world. you know, here, because it's short, I want to read, I'm going to actually read it through, and we can actually go through and pick it out afterwards, but I want to read this through.
We're going to have the Jeff version of Bechokotai?
Yes. Well, this is actually the Everett Fox version of Bechokotai. So, let's see. Chapter 26, verse 3. If by my laws you walk, and my commandments you keep and observe them, then I will go forth. Give forth your rains in their set time, that so that the earth gives forth its yield, and its trees of the field give forth their fruit. Threshing will overtake vintage for you, and vintage will overtake sowing, and you shall eat your food to being satisfied, and be settled in security in your land. And I will give peace throughout the land, so that you will lie down, and none will make you tremble. I will cause to cease wild beasts from your land, and the sword shall not cross through your land. And you shall
amen.
And you shall pursue your enemies, and they shall fall before your sword. Five of you shall pursue 100, and 100 of you, a myriad shall pursue. You shall pursue a myriad. Your enemies falling before you to the sword. I will turn my face towards you, making you fruitful, making you many, and I will establish my covenant with you. And you will eat old grain. The oldest stored and the old for the new you will have to clear out. And I will place my dwelling in your midst, and I will not repel you. I will walk about in your midst. I will be for you as a God, and you yourselves will be for me as a people. I, Yehovah, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. From being serfs to them, I broke the bars of your yoke, enabling you to walk upright. But if you do not hearken to me, so I want to stop right there. So, Yoel, this seems to be life in a non-at-risk place. You're not at risk of being overrun. You're not at risk of being of losing your wealth. You're not at risk of losing your family to invaders, or your house, or your flocks, or your vineyards. This seems to be somewhat Edenic. You know, it says that your planting is going to be so profitable that you're going to have to clear out last year's grain and the year before that grain just to make room for the new grain. And that it's going to be a constant overflowing of bounty. That, you know, it's not going to be, it sounds like it's not going to be the sweat of the brow toiling in the soil. And I assume that women wouldn't, you know, suffer in childbirth and so forth as well. It doesn't mention it, but, you know, it seems to be that this is, if we walk according to his ways, this is in the land, this is talking about as they go into the land, this isn't necessarily for us right now, but in the time when they were getting ready to go into the land, he says, if you do this, it's going to be like Eden. Do you kind of agree with that idea?
No.
Okay.
Sorry about that, but the answer is no. The reason I disagree with that is, first of all, because the description here is not really Edenic. It's not Eden. It's actually a description that's not a utopia. Eden, the Garden of Eden, or Eden, is presented as a utopia, as a reality where there's no death, no trouble, nothing whatsoever. Everyone lives a beautiful, pink, fluffy life, and so on. Here, the text clearly indicates that there's still evil in the world. There is still war in the world. And if you have any enemies that try to attack you, you will be able to defeat them with no difficulty. That there'll be no evil animals in your land. That you'll be flourishing, but you still have to go and harvest your fields and work in your fields like everyone else. So it's not a utopia as Eden. It's actually just a flourishing, safe reality that you live in. Okay? Is there a stage sometime when we return to Eden? That can be another discussion that we already agreed upon that we might have.
Okay.
But the thing, what's described here is this, a secure nation living on its land, from its land, with no real dangers, no feasible dangers whatsoever. But it's not as if you're living in some utopia that doesn't exist at the moment. It's still on our earth. And it actually reminds me of a debate between two sages in the Talmud, where one sage says that the times of the Mashiach, this wonderful utopia, and so on and so forth, and another rabbi says, no, the world will continue to be the world. It's just, it's going to be with a better connection to God. There's going to be a lot more goodness in the world, but it's still going to be the world we live in. And that seems to be more the type of description of what we have here. This can actually be seen as the prototype for the Messianic era.
Sure.
Prior to the forgiveness of the sin of Gan Eden.
Now, so when we look at, now obviously this is talking about during the time when there'll be people in the land during the days following Moses, or even actually by this time he was actually going to be involved, that if they lived right, it was going to be near Edenic.
Near Edenic sounds very good.
Okay, near Edenic. Which would the difference between this time and what I assume when we're talking about the seven-day Sabbath, the seventh year Shemitah, the seventh Shemitah Yovel, I do wonder whether or not there's just not one point in time in the future where Eden will be restored. There'll be a Yovel for the earth or for the creation. And that's when this time is supposed to be, when it's truly Edenic again. But not necessarily the whole world, just in the land of Eden, in my assumption. And this is how Israel could live from any time before that until the time of the Yovel, or whatever you want to call it. That the proto-Edenic or the near-Edenic type life is capable if Israel were to walk correctly. That makes a lot of sense to me in how the Bible how the Torah plays it out.
Oh yeah, I mean, if Israel walks in the footsteps of what the Torah says, they can bring goodness to the world in what we do, and everything can flourish and become a light to the nations. And people would say, well, how is it that the Israelite people are so successful, and they'll come here, and if slowly the world can be fixed, and then humanity as a general, because you have to remember, in Garden of Eden, there wasn't Israel or anything, it was Adam and Eve,
right,
humanity.
Right, right.
And all of humanity will be able to learn from the ways of the Creator to reach a point where they will be able to enter this, all human race can be able to enter into this Edenic period. What's very interesting here, also notice the fact that the way I'm presenting it is through a peaceful way, through learning by experience, learning from seeing things, from learning it from the five senses of seeing, understanding, tasting, touching, and so on. It's not as if you're supposed to go out and spread this faith by sword or by force or by telling people what to believe or not believe. It is a system that you see, you can perceive with your actual senses, and then you go, okay, this seems to be truthful. And this is a very, very different way of how some religions are spread, that you have to go out and you have to tell everyone about this or force them or whatever. No, if there's something that has truth in it, humanity at the end will be drawn towards it.
There's actually a verse, I can't remember where it is in the Torah. I'm pretty sure Moses says it, but it says that that when you walk correctly, it may actually be in this portion, I just haven't seen it for some reason, where it says, if you walk correctly, then God will bless you, and then all the nations round about will see the blessings of God on you, and they will turn and give God the glory. That seems to be the only soul winning that the Torah ever talks about, and that is that you live right, you have a lifestyle that receives blessings from God, and then the nations around you will see those blessings, and they will turn of their own volition to God. You don't have to convince them with your words at all.
That's, if I'm not mistaken, Deuteronomy.
Okay, okay. So, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, the verse is hovering in my head in Hebrew, but it's not coming out, so...
Every year I say the same thing. I've got to write this down. I've got to write this down. But for some reason, I just don't remember to write it down. But really, it seems like that what we're getting here from this portion is specifically that when Israel walks uprightly, Israel the nation, not necessarily you and I as individuals. I mean, we can have a discussion about that at some point, Yoel, as you know, we've already kind of mentioned it before, is how does God deal with us individually during exile? There's not a lot of information in the text to support any choices. But, you know, it seems to be when the nation as a body is working together in the Torah and in the covenant, I will establish my covenant with you. I think that's a very important term that we need to focus on, is the idea that this is a covenant. The Torah is instructions about the covenant, but the covenant is what actually seals us to him. And, you know, that if you do this, he'll establish his covenant with you. The next part of the discussion is, if you don't, then he's not going to establish his covenant with you. As a matter of fact, verse 17 says that I will set my face against you, and you will be hit by plague in the face of your enemies, and those who hate you will have dominion over you. Well, you know, that kind of brings us, kind of helps us set up for the Hosea discussion, because in Hosea, we've talked about it for several weeks now, that Judah as well as Israel went into subdominion to the Assyrians. They became vassals to the Assyrians. And that God says that when that happens, there's been a change in our relationship. There's been a change in your position in the covenant. And that's kind of what Hosea is all talking about. I don't want to go to Hosea just yet, but, you know, this seems to be the, you know, if you do this, I'll bless you. If you don't do this, then I'm going to just basically set you out from the covenant.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, there's this saying, Talmudic saying, that says the prophets did not come but to enforce the words of Moses. And really, when you go to the last verse is in the book of Malachi, and I pointed this out many times, Zichru Torat Moshe Avdi, remember the law of Moses, my servant, the last prophet in the Hebrew Bible, because the Christian Bible sets things up differently to fit a certain approach. But the Hebrew Bible, the last prophet, because Daniel is not seen really as a prophet in the Jewish perspective, and there's reasons for it. I actually had someone ask me about this about a day ago, 2 days ago, how come it happens like that. But the point is that the prophets will mirror what the Torah says. Unlike, for example, what Martin Buber tried to argue back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where he tried to claim that the prophets presented a new ideology that was unknown prior to them. Actually, when you read through a book like Hosea is saying, you sinned. Jeremiah says, you sinned. Isaiah says, you sinned. Ezekiel says, they're all repeating the same thing, that part of the covenant, and they say, and this is going to happen to you. I am going to punish you. They're basically repeating what is said here in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But they also remember the good part, the first part we have here, which says, no, if you follow my ways, this is what's going to happen, and so on. Okay? So we actually find that prophets are really mostly reinforcing what the Torah is saying. Okay? You take a description. There are different descriptions here. Okay, for example, the times of, the problem, I'll put it this, the problem is as follows. When you look at the historical point of view of what happened with Israel, there was always a problem, always issues. Mm-hmm. But you do find, you do find when kings did follow the Torah, at least to whatever degree they followed it, suddenly there is some kind of a quiet in the land. And most of what we know is from the perspective of Judah. What happened in the north is usually presented from a critical point of view. This is why a book like Hosea is priceless, because it's one of the very, very few places that we actually have a perspective from the north. I mean, as I mentioned when we started dealing with Hosea, I said that there are elements in his language which are northern. I actually had a reminder of this during Shabbat. I was reading an article about the language in general in the Tanakh, and you know, because I teach Hebrew, so I read a lot of articles on the subject, and it's very interesting to see the perspective of Hosea. But Hosea is basically saying very, very similar things to what we see here. He's chastising them on the main issues, which are mostly social, by the way, but he says to them, you will be punished. But what the question is, where did this, what's the authority that he has as a prophet to claim that there will be punishment? What is the authority of anyone starting from Samuel to Nathan to all the latter prophets that we have, with Amos, who is considered to be one of the earliest written prophets, into Hosea and Yoel and all the minor prophets, and then go into Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel? What is their authority to even claim that there can be a punishment? And the authority is because they are a prophet like Moses. They have a connection with God and they receive word from God. Okay? And they derive the possibility of punishment or blessing from the Torah itself. They, and Ezekiel is a very unique case, but the prophets in general have no right to undermine what the Torah says.
Amen.
And this is what, and this is what we have, for example, in Deuteronomy, where it says, if a person shows up and they say they're a prophet, but they're changing the Torah by saying, go worship idols and so on, that's really the main focus there. Because if a person shows up and he's a false prophet, but he claims to be speaking in the name of the God of Israel, and all he's telling them is, go do this and go that, do that, but he's not leading them away from Torah, then there's a question, what do you do with such a person? But the prophets themselves, except for Ezekiel, and Ezekiel, the end of Ezekiel is a big, big question. There's a lot of dilemmas about what Ezekiel meant there and so on. But I think we have some reasonable answers to those questions. But still, they can't derive their authority of what they claim if Moses didn't exist, if the Torah wasn't given. And they base the entire idea of a chastising prophet, because we, if you remember, Shmuel is more of a leader type of prophet. Natan is more of a leader type of prophet. It's when we go into the minor prophets or the major prophets, and these are no longer leader prophets. These are more individuals that spoke to the public and so on, that they continue what the leader prophets said, but now they do it from another side of the field, from the defense or offense, you want to think, not from the side of the king, not from the side of the kingdom. They're actually saying, look, you as a nation, you entire thing known as Israel, as a nation with your priests and kings and so on, you're still all bound to this Torah. This includes every last one of you. So I am coming as an authority from the Torah, which is above every last one of you, including your king and high priest, and I tell you in the name of God, what it says here, either good or bad, is going to happen. And this is where I derive my authority from, the prophet would say to them. And this is why the end of Malachi says, Zichru Torat Moshe Avdi. Remember the laws of my servant Moses.
Let me
because
ask.
With
I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Can you continue that thought? I'll ask in a second.
No, I can say I'm done.
Okay, you mentioned that there's, you know, the leadership type prophets. Samuel is a good example of that. Then you have the more chastisement type of prophets that talk about judgment. And, you know, that's a vast majority of the prophets, per se, are basically chastisement related. Now, you mentioned Joel, and in Joel, it talks about, you know, pretty much some kind of large gap of time. We don't know. I mean, looking back, we can say it's been 2,700 years or 2,500 years, however long it's been. But, you know, it talks about at a given point in the later days, then your sons and daughters will see signs and so forth. What kind of prophets do you think those will be? Do you think those will be restitutionists, restorationists, you know, reconstructionists? Because they won't be chastisement, would they?
Well, that seems to be more of an Edenic ideology. The same way Adam spoke to God directly, that he says, your children are going to have a much closer relationship with God. When you say someone is a prophet, what exactly is a prophet? A prophet essentially is a man who is the oracle of God, the spokesman of God, I'll call it the megaphone of God. But he voices what God says. But
he's the Torah crier, like town crier.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he stands there, hear ye, hear, he rings a bell.
Exactly.
The British are coming, the British are coming. Yeah. In any case, the point is that's a function that came to be as when people were individualized, as individual prophets, as people who were unique in the fact that they're prophets. But prior to that, Adam, as the first human, Adam and Eve as the first humans, spoke with God, and that was the original ideal. That man and God will not be separated. The man and God will be able to communicate directly with one another without difficulty. But because man decided to go in the direction he decided to go, he severed that connection. And this is why God has to look for individuals to voice him, to be his voice on earth. And I think that what we're seeing here, the usage of the word Nevi'im, because it doesn't mean that there will be prophets in the same way that we see prophets as leader prophets or chastising prophets and prophets of promises of goodness and so on. We're actually looking at reversing back into the ideal state of mankind. Mm. There are more and more humans will be in a harmony with the Creator, that they'll be able to be in a situation where they speak with God directly without a doubt. And not as if they have some kind of a notion, oh, I feel God is speaking to me, that they will know that this man is a prophet. There will be no doubt that they are communicating with God. You have to remember that when you look at, for example, I think it's Zechariah, it mentions that no longer men will wear an aderet, which is a certain type of clothing, of hair, usually goat hair, and maybe to represent like as if they got wild hair, as we find prophets sometimes were seen as crazy men. For example, Elijah had basically crazy hair. It says that he's a Baal Se'ar. It's kind of funny that I bring it up now, because I was actually staying in the post office today, and I was talking with the guard there, and we're actually talking about Elijah, which is kind of interesting. It's pretty surprising. You see a man that's secular and so on, but he knows his Bible. That was very, very up. It was very cheering to hear what he had to say about certain things. And that people no longer have to pretend as if they're speaking with God. There'll be no longer this uniqueness and having to look as if you're a madman. No, you speaking with God will be a normal thing. It'll be something that will be seen as perfectly normal when mankind returns to his normal state of being much more spiritual and connected to his Creator.
Now, I really appreciate that viewpoint on it, because it does say in Joel that, you know, it's your sons and daughters will prophesy and see dreams. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that, because if we look at the idea of a prophet in the past, there were, you know, at most two or three prophets operating at the same time. But it seems like in Joel, it's referring to something that could be seen as even a more commonality. You're mentioning that people would at that point, and this is talking about something that happens as part, directly part of the restoration, it seems. You know, for the last 2,000 years, people having their, you know, personal experiences with God wouldn't necessarily count. This is something that's supposed to happen towards the end, it seems. And that it's going to be not just a prophet that stands up to lead the people, it's going to be maybe all Israel. I don't know. What do you think? Because it, sons and daughters doesn't necessarily imply one person speaking to the millions.
Oh, it seems to be it's going to be something that's going to be very widespread. How widespread, we don't know. But he says that more, basically it sounds like he says more and more humans, more and more people will be able to be on the level of a prophet. That more and more people will be in that position, that humanity is becoming more and more pure in its ways. He says he's probably speaking to the general public. He's not talking to the high echelon of society. He's talking to the regular people in front of him. He says, your children, do as if I'm standing in, in the middle of a McDonald's. Okay?
Okay. Why would you be in a McDonald's? No, go ahead.
A kosher McDonald's.
Okay.
And by the way, the kosher McDonald's here, the McDonald's here in Israel, by the way, apparently uses real potatoes and real beef and real buns, apparently. Wow. I spoke with a friend of mine who's, he checked it, and a friend that doesn't keep kosher, and he said, no, it's very different here in Israel. But in any case, I did once eat at a kosher McDonald's together with my friend Nechemi Goren, and this was on an Aviv search, and we felt terrible for like 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something wrong there. It might have been the bread. I mean, we're not too sure. But in any case, I'm taking McDonald's as an example because who are the type of people mostly eat at McDonald's? Simple people that want to buy a meal for $1.50. I don't know, whatever the prices are. So these are mostly regular people, everyday life, hard workers, some unemployed and so on. And these are like the lower parts of society. Okay? And I hope I haven't offended anyone who eats at McDonald's in their high society. I don't know. But
right.
The way McDonald's is pictured here in Israel, it's most people that eat there in the U.S. or the people that don't have money.
But yeah, you turn around to kind of in the value meal. The whole idea of a value meal restaurant is not necessarily geared towards the Paris Hiltons of the world. So you haven't offended anybody.
Exactly. Okay. So you walk into a McDonald's and you say, your children are going to be prophets. It's like a guy who works in a grocery store. The guy is a farmer. This guy, I don't know, works under the hood in an auto repair shop. And he says to him, "No, your children, you, the regular people, the people who have to work really hard for your living, your children are going to reach the highest level of spiritual ability and would excel over the rest of humanity." This is basically what he's telling, because you have to remember, prophets spoke to everyone. But the majority of people who would go and listen to a prophet were usually the laymen. For the higher people in society had to be spoken to indirectly towards by a prophet. Like, for example, Hoshea. He mentions the high echelon of society. Did he actually speak with them directly? No. It seems to be that he was standing in the middle of a public area where most of the people walk around, they're just laymen. And he would tell his prophecies, and these words would usually either fall in the ears of people, rich people who have gone through the market, or that through the rumors, through the Jew vine, or the Israelite vine, will reach the king's court and so on. And we actually hear this, by the way, we see this in Amos. Amos is attacked by the priest of Bet-El, where the priest of Bet-El is saying, telling the king what Amos is actually saying. So this is the same thing. Okay? So it seems to be that what he's telling them is that your children, you as the regular people, are going to be the best of humanity. Which means that it's going to be something very widespread. Humanity will fix itself.
At least those of the covenant.
Well, I assume that, for example, if Yoel says this, he's talking to people who are in Jerusalem. It seems to be that most of the people there will be people of the covenant.
Right,
The prophets do speak about the nations, but it's only really, I would say, Jeremiah who speaks directly to the nations.
Mm-hmm.
The prophets speak about the nations. Jeremiah is one of the very few, if not the only one, who actually speaks to the nations. He writes a letter in Aramaic. There's this one verse in the book of Jeremiah. It's actually in Aramaic. Okay? It actually says, Kedna tomerun lehon. This is what you will say to them. And he gives a quote that the people who listen to him have to go and say to the nations. He corresponds with the people who come to visit King Zedekiah. He speaks to their messengers or sends a message to the messengers. He writes a letter to Babylon. He's the prophet that can be seen as also as a prophet to the nations, unlike the rest of the prophets that seem to be more closed inside Israel.
True. Jeremiah also wrote to nations who were directly involved with Israel too, warning them not to overdo the, God bringing them and using them for judging Israel. Don't overdo it. So it's really not, he's just talking to the nations in general. He's talking to the nations who are directly impacting Israel, right?
Yeah, I mean, he has general prophecies, but he's also talking directly to certain groups.
Yeah, okay.
His interaction, it's very interesting, his interaction with the Babylonians, for example, is very, very, very direct. He speaks with the ministers, he speaks with the soldiers, he's this very, very unique prophet who is much more involved with his surroundings. Isaiah was in the king's court. There's even this midrash that claims that Isaiah was a relative of the king, his father-in-law, there's a whole story though, I won't explain it now, but he might have been involved in seeing ministers from other countries and so on, but he wasn't really speaking to them directly. When the king of Babylon, Mordach Baladan, son of Baladan, comes to visit, he doesn't speak with them. He goes to the king, King Hezekiah, and says, "Who were these men?" He doesn't speak with them directly. Ezekiel seems to be more communicating with the people and the elders. And then the minor prophets seem to be localized prophets that speak to like really small groups. So Jeremiah really can be seen as the prophet that speaks to the rest of the nations. And Jeremiah, by the way, is also seen as having strong connections to the book of Deuteronomy. By the way, a lot of his language is actually from Deuteronomy, which shows that the prophets, again, like I said earlier, the prophets derive their authority from the Torah.
Well, a lot of people don't necessarily keep this in mind when they're thinking about this, but most of these prophets, that's what they had for quote-unquote Bible, was Deuteronomy, if not maybe the first five books, but definitely Deuteronomy. That was the textbook of serving God for 1,000 years, right?
It's like 960 years, something like that.
Yeah. So when we talk today and we talk about, we got all these prophets to read. Well, all the prophets read, for the most part, one book. And, people just don't, for whatever reason, don't find it necessary to go back and read that same book. I think Deuteronomy is the most important book for us to read.
It seems to be that Deuteronomy is a real, it's like the layman version of the Torah. Okay, it kind of collects most of what the Torah says and kind of puts it into a very compressed version. It seems to be that there's even this argument that Deuteronomy was the book read during the Hakel, which by the way, just to cover a question here, someone asked me about the Hakel, and I apologize for bringing this up now in the middle of recording about Bechukotai and Hoshea, but there is this question: when do you actually do the Akel? And the Akel is actually done on Sukkot, and they claim that the king would read from Deuteronomy. And there's a question: when is it done? And it's really a question of calendars: which calendar you go by, the feast calendar, the agricultural calendar, and so on. So Sukkot falls on that border where it's really the middle of the year the middle of the year when it comes to the feast calendar, but then it's kind of like can be seen as the end of the agriculture year on the border of the new agricultural year. Mm-hmm. Agricultural year begins somewhere
daytime
around
and
the
nighttime. 70s. I like it. That's how I look at it. Daytime and nighttime.
It depends on the type of calendar you're going to be looking at, daytime and nighttime, with harvest versus basically summer versus winter.
Yeah.
And it's on that border. This is why there are places where it seems to be as if it's the beginning of the year and places it seems to be the end of the year, but that's talking from the perspective of an agricultural year. Mm-hmm. From the perspective of a feast year, then it's really the middle of the year. But the Akel is done on the Shemitah year, and the Shemitah year is part of the agricultural calendar. So it's kind of like at the beginning, but also at the end, because it's the end of the harvest, but it's almost the beginning of planting and whatever the words are in English to describe putting seeds in the ground.
Sowing
the ground.
It's Sukkot is the evening meal, and then the land rests. And then you go out and start working it in the morning, and then your first gathering is Pesach, unleavened bread, and then the last gathering is the Sukkot, and the night begins again, and the cycle is over and over. I think it's perfect. So, basically, what we're dealing with in the idea of Israel being set apart, if they do things right, they'll be set apart for blessings. If they do things wrong, they'll be set apart from the covenant. And at that point, they're actually living in an at-risk state again. We spoke about that if they lived correctly, then they would live in a near Edenic time. And if they wouldn't, then they would be oppressed, and they would be hunted and hounded and stolen from and just mistreated. Well, what I'm looking for and what we're talking about here in Yoel is just, you know, the promise that our sons and daughters, or maybe even us, because we're the sons and daughters of them, will one day wake up with a relationship with God that we haven't seen since at least Moses' time, or maybe some of the prophets' time. David spoke with God, but maybe it'll be like David. But, you know, there's a restoration. There's a promise that it's going to come back, that it's going to be like it was in Eden. So there is an Edenic flavor to the idea of restoration, at least the ultimate restoration, right?
Yeah, well, again, when we talk about Leviticus, we're talking about one stage. When we're talking about Yoel, we're talking about another stage.
Sure, yes, truly. Leviticus is talking about the near Edenic state that's going to happen as long as Israel lives correctly in the land. What Yoel seems to be talking about is the ultimate, the final chapter of what the near Eden of Israel will become, the restored Eden of Adam. Is that safe to say? Kind of. There's probably a whole lot of definitions we need to clarify, but basically, is that kind of in a
nutshell, the direction is correct. The problem is that the prophecies don't go all the way to that point of the Garden of Eden. They kind of stop at one point and don't transition into the Garden of Eden.
Well, the whole idea is to take this back into Hosea, where we're in chapter 11, where it it starts by saying, "When Israel was a child, I loved him and I called him out of Egypt." And then it goes on to talk about, you know, they when they were doing well, they were blessed, and when they weren't doing well, he set a judgment upon them. And we're building up into mm-hmm. Hosea 14, which talks about what Joel is talking about, that there's going to be a final restoration where things get fixed. So, you know, as we're kind mm-hmm. of building up for the final of Hosea, I think I want to really build up to the idea of this time where we get not just restored as a nation in the land like David, but we get restored as a nation in our inheritance like Adam. I think that's really the hope and the promise that we're looking for from this point in time. Is that right?
Well, again, because these prophecies are directly towards Israel and Israel in its suffering after what happened, I think that talking about the Garden of Eden is something that you know, because you're promising something to all of humanity, and at that time, Israel sees humanity, especially because we're talking about a world where they didn't know everyone. It's not like today that you can, with a click of a button, be in contact with someone from the other side of the globe.
Right, right.
Back then, you know, the world was the people they met, and these people were essentially their enemies, okay? And because they were their enemies, they wouldn't tolerate hearing a prophecy about, and all of humanity is going to go into this wonderful world. They'll go like, but they were mean to us. They killed us. So I think that might be one of the reasons why the prophets did not speak all the way to the Garden of Eden. They kind of stopped mourning the promises for Israel. And obviously, they said, you know, the rest of the world will be blessed by these good things. But then you also have to remember, go to Zechariah, and Zechariah says that a goodness is going to be in Israel, but if the nations, for example, don't come to the temple on Chag HaSukkot, on the Feast of Booths, then no, they're going to be punished. They'll have this disease that will attack them, or it won't rain where they live. So it's interesting why the prophets speak about up to that stage and don't go beyond, and this might be the reason, because that the Jews at the time, the Israelites at the time, were not ready to hear such a prophecy. And hear this type of prophecy when prophecy comes back and things become restored, then we might start hearing prophecies of the Garden of Eden. But I will mention that, and this is something we might expand upon some other time, we have to remember that the temple is a type of Eden.
Right, right. They have the cherubim that block it and everything, yeah.
Yeah. And it seems to be that, you know, there are things that the temple would replace the Garden of Eden, at least for a while. But it never goes beyond that point.
Sure, sure. And whenever I was making the comment, it wasn't so much that I was including all the world getting back to Eden so much. Specifically, the covenant is, with those of the covenant, their inheritance is this land, the land flowing with milk and honey, that, you know, the whole idea of Eden. But like in Isaiah, another one of the prophets, it says that, you know, there's going to be blessings that flow out from Israel, from Jerusalem specifically, and all the nations that do come, and all the nations that you know submit themselves or whatever to these blessings will receive the blessings freely, but there will be others that don't. So I think during the whole idea of Israel in the inheritance as the inheritors, I don't know if David's time they were truly the inheritors yet, because I think the inheritors really talks about the whole time when Eden is restored, that concept. But, you know, the nations, they aren't restored until they come. They'll just be 1,000 years or 2,000 years or 100,000 years, however long it lasts. It only says forevermore in the text. You know, that they'll learn and they'll have the opportunity, and it won't be about faith. They'll see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting. I'm going to key for a second about that issue of faith versus actually seeing, because this is something very, very, very important. I mean, we take a prophet like Hosea, and Hosea, as I said, takes his authority from the Torah, and he says to them, if the covenant that I am talking about has a good side and a bad side, and you will see the bad side happening. It's not as if you're going to have to walk in faith to believe that I'm speaking the truth here.
Right. We know there's been bad. We don't have to have faith that there's a judgment going on, right?
Yeah. And this really is a really interesting thing, because sometimes people ask me, how do we know the good things are going to happen? And I've mentioned this story before, but I mentioned it again very quickly. There's a story about Rabbi Akiva that when he and his friends went to the temple after the destruction of the second temple, they reached Jerusalem and they tore their clothing and they cried, and when they saw the temple in ruins, they threw ash on their heads and so on, and then they saw a fox running out, but they're all crying and Rabbi Akiva started laughing. And they looked at him and said, completely off your rocker, what do you mean you're laughing? He said, you know, before the bad things happened, I was concerned that none of it's actually going to happen. When the bad things happened, I realized that the good things will happen as
Amen.
Well.
Amen. If Dad says he'll spank you if you do wrong, Dad also will also bless you when you do right. It's a promise.
Exactly. So there's an interesting element here of seeing. You know, you have to ask yourself a question. Why would the prophets go on and on and on about all these bad things? Last recording, I mentioned the fact that I'm getting kind of tired of talking about all these bad things. But now that we're talking about blessings and curses and so on, and we're looking in Hosea, and Hosea saying all these bad things, but Hosea is also mentioning the good things. He also remembers that there's a goodness, that I called you my son, and I brought you out of Egypt, okay, and so on. And you need to ask yourself a question about the purpose of saying all these bad things and saying all these good things. And the point is that these are tangible things. These are tangible. These are things that you'll be able to see with your eyes, feel, touch, smell, and so on. And it's not something just by faith. This is a major difference that you find between the Torah and, say, whatever other religion out there. You have to believe that something happened. No, these are things that can be seen all the time. You know, there's this great question of why is there anti-Semitism? And people say, truthfully, anti-Semitism doesn't make any sense. Why there's anti-Semitism is very simple. I mean, I can explain why people are anti-Semitic to this very day and why some of it's really rampaging and so on. It's a very, very long process that went on for thousands of years of brainwashing and so on, and society seeing this as a type of norm. But at the end of the day, what would drive a Roman historian, for example, to hate Jews so much? Okay, there are tangible reasons for this. You know, when I can't remember what his name was now, but there's a Roman historian that speaks really very a lot of ill about Jews. And his hatred is really something that doesn't make any sense, because they're lazy because they have a day off from work. They have no idols. They're obviously, and he's talking about things that today, well, that's their culture, you know, get over it. But you have to ask yourself a question, why did it happen? And the reason it happened, the reason the Romans had this ambivalent relationship with Jews, that they loved them because they're an ancient race, an ancient people, but on the other hand, they don't really go by the Roman norms, is something that probably can be explained through the idea that there has to be a spark of good and a spark of evil at all times to enable good and bad to happen. And the bad is not rational, because it is a curse presented by God for not following Torah. The real reason that he hates you is not because, you know, you're keeping your Sabbath. That's completely and utter nonsense. It's because there's something else, something spiritual working in the background.
It kind of reminds me of Isaiah 52 and 3. You know, we beat this guy. We shoved him in the dirt. We did everything we did, but yet God lifted him back up.
Well, I'm after refraining from commenting on Isaiah.
Well, I'm talking, when I say guy, I mean, that's kind of the context there, but it's talking about Israel. And, you know, they've stomped Israel. They've beat Israel. They've put him in the gas chamber. They've done all these things, yet, because Israel was told these were going to happen because of your exile, these were going to happen because of your disobedience, then just like Rabbi Akiva says, now we know that the promises of goodness are just as real.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If there's bad, there's also good. You know, there's this,
for those
there's
in the
saying,
covenant, yes.
Yeah, exactly. There's this saying, what is darkness without light? And what is light without darkness? You can't see the light without knowing that there's darkness, and you can't comprehend light you can't comprehend light without seeing darkness. You can't comprehend darkness without seeing light. You have to have the contrast to be able to see the difference between them.
Or maybe we could use the word appreciate. You can't appreciate what light is unless you've seen something without light. Maybe that, but something something I wanted to bring up when you were talking a minute ago. Have you heard of the Stockholm syndrome? You know, Patty Hearst, and, you know, they kind of, you fall in love with your captors.
Mm-hmm.
Israel, as a whole, seems over the last several thousand years to have thought that this is just life. You know, that this is just life. There's nothing, we're not expecting goodness to come, because our lot in life is to, you know, can you please choose someone else for a while, God? That kind of mentality.
So there's a problem in what you're saying, because you're saying Israel, but not too sure what you mean as Israel.
I'm leaving it general as opposed to saying Jew.
Well, the thing is that really you can't use that example as Israel, as the entirety of Israel, because what you're describing is mostly something that happened to what we call the Jewish people. Though the Jewish people very clearly do contain parts of the other tribes as well, and this is something, by the way, factual.
Sure, absolutely.
That I've done some research on, and there's no doubt that Jews today contain lots of people from the other tribes. And there's this whole question about, was the land really empty and were the tribes really all exiled? But the point is that what you're describing is more about Jews. And I can only speak about this from the perspective of Jews because, unlike, for example, other Israelites who've lost their identity and don't exactly know where they're from and might not even be aware of the fact that they're Israelites, the only thing that I can talk about is from Jewish perspective. And mm-hmm. when it comes to Jews are a very, very complex reality, because on the one hand, you speak about Jews all the way into the 1700s, and you have to speak about Jews from the 1700s onwards, and then you have to talk about Jews from 1882 and the late 1800s when the Zionist movement began, and they have to talk about Jews after the creation of the State of Israel, and they have to talk about Jews in modern times, today, after 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. So it's a very, very complex thing to talk about, because you have to talk about each period differently and types of people and so on. There were different ideologies that developed, but I don't think, at least people who continued carrying the torch of faith, I don't think that people forgot that there's an end, that at one point this will change. Actually, to tell the truth, that's actually the main thing that kept Jews going.
Beautiful. Okay.
And when Jews let go of, when certain Jews started letting go of faith, that's when they started saying, oh, okay, we don't really need to think in this way anymore, and therefore started abandoning certain things. Oh, God has completely abandoned us and so on. But that only happened when the age of enlightenment started hitting Jews around the world, especially the beginning, it really started in Germany, because of Friedrich II or Friedrich the Great, didn't necessarily emancipate, but his approach towards Jews was much more open and much more forgiving, especially because he was actually very anti-church. His entire approach to church was very, I don't like you guys. So he also saw no reason to treat Jews badly. And then Jews started learning all these different anti-religious ideas and so on. And then that's when people started abandoning and forgetting certain things and forgetting that there is a future and saying, listen, it's abandoned everything and it's become like everyone else, everything's going to be fine. Obviously, the Holocaust was evidence that that's not going to work. Okay, the Holocaust was the very, 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 very painful slap in the face for the Jewish people, that no matter what we do, there's always going to be a hatred towards us. The problem, by the way, talking about the Holocaust is very, very taboo here in Israel. That there's the discussion of the spiritual elements of the Holocaust are very, very problematic. And there have been cases where people have said stuff and it really exploded. I mean, I once said something about it and people completely exploded at me. And I said, well, you're exploding, but at the end of the day, you know I'm right. You know, when people talk about the Holocaust and they start talking about God, that becomes very, very explosive. Because people when they come out of a suffering, they can treat suffering in two different ways. They can be very melancholy, or they can be very hopeful. And I think that the people who go anti-God, which it might be something that Hosea had to deal with as well, people go anti-God, that's really a melancholy situation where they see everything from a negative perspective. But on the other hand, after the Holocaust, something changed in the world. And you know, as a person living in Israel, you're torn between the Holocaust being one of the most detrimental realities ever to happen to our people, but then you also look at the light that happened after that. Mm-hmm. But then again, you're torn again because of the hatred towards Israel, because of, you know, propaganda, anti-Semitic propaganda has taken now a new form, anti-Zionism, but it's still anti-Semitism, period. And then, you know, you also look at what's going on here in Israel today as a group of people, and the words of Hosea echo back into our society, that you see that people came back here and certain things are crumbling, and it's really heartbreaking. I mean, when I talk with people about, you know, keep Torah to some extent. Why do I need this anymore? And I said, because this is the law of our people. This is the ways of our people. You're here because of this book. You're here because of these prophecies. This is not some kind of mad messianic ideas that some people might try to present. But at the end of the day, you came here and your parents came here because of these prophecies, because of this hope of redemption. Not only because it can be a safe house for Jews from the dangers of around of the world, but also because it is the promised land and the home of our people, trying to fulfill these prophecies. And there's this long debate between religious Zionists and secular Zionists about the purpose of secular Zionism. And people say this is the donkey that Messiah rides upon. That even in the problematic reality we live in here today in Israel, we are still hoping, we are still waiting, and we read these words like Hosea, and we yearn to hear the voice of God again. So I don't think it's died out. I think that there's damage. I think there's a battle going on because of brainwashing people. I mean, when I speak with people about religion, most of them are very ignorant. And most of them don't stop to think about what they're saying. They're just spewing out different ideas and things that are not necessarily true or not necessarily correct.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think about my father. He's basically studied himself into a place where, you know, I don't know when he made these choices, but I've never known him to be religious at all. Never known him to necessarily have a positive opinion on anything dealing with Judaism or Torah. But, you know, it seems that there's a lot of things happened in this last generation or two. I can also see at the same time that we have the other side of the coin is there are movements within Judaism, which, you know, focusing on that for the moment, that are definitely reaching out to those who desire to come under the same covenant. They're reaching out to that. So I see a much greater movement now than I've seen ever in the history of Israel. That also I think is just a huge blessing. So that even though there's been a rise in agnosticism and a rise in atheism amongst the Hebrew people in the last, you know, generation, I think there's also been a rise in the idea of reaching out to a world that's, you know, basically needs help, needs answers, wants to have a reason to do right. Because there's a lot of people out here in the world that just are wicked, terrible people, just allowed the darkness in their hearts to just overwhelm them. Anyhow, so we've got in Hosea 11, he's again talking about the reason for them going off into judgment, and the reason that this has come upon them. And he kind of in the middle of it, he says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I deliver you, Israel? How can I make you as Admah? And how can I set you as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me. My repentings are kindled together. I will not execute the fierceness of my anger. I will not return to destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not enter into the city. It seems that he just demonstrates a desire to see restoration, even in the midst of him being completely right to sue us until the last penny is taken, and to use today's vernacular. But he extends grace even when judgment is what's called for. I still think about all those people that taught me for 30 years and that I taught others for 30 years that, you know, God of the Old Testament was a God of anger and wrath. It really just doesn't fit. There's times when dad has to spank his son, but it doesn't mean he's a God of anger and wrath.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that when you have a child that misbehaves, then it feels like the father is always a father of wrath and so on. But I think, you know, I have a son, for example, who's a bit of a wild card sometimes. He overdoes it. I mean, we have the regular difficulties with our oldest son who's almost a teenager, and he kind of gets frustrated because he thinks he's an adult, but he isn't yet, so he fights with us over really silly things and so on. But then you have like a 5-year-old who's still clearly a child, but He ignores you. He does whatever he wants. He's completely oblivious of his surroundings and so on. And it becomes more and more frustrating as a parent that when a child does things like that. So the child starts seeing as if the parent is always angry with him and always yelling and so on, and really forgets the good things, really forgets the fact that they had, you know, last week he had fun and he went out and he did this and did that and whatever it might be. The child really focuses on the bad things, and this is really a psychological thing that many of us have, that we tend to forget the good and really focus on the bad. But it's really a lot like that. And you really, a prophecy like this, where he says, I have to slap you, but I'm doing this while I'm crying, at least in the inside, it's a very, very big thing to say, because this is a great contrast between, for example, the way deities were present the ancient world to the God of Israel. The God of Israel cares for his creations, cares for his people, but he also has a covenant to you. There's an agreement, and an agreement you have to sometimes enforce it. You can't turn a blind eye all the time. You have to sometimes put your foot down and basically say, no, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be like this, and no matter what you do, I'm going to have to enforce it. There's an agreement between God and his people, or a parent and his child, and so on. Sometimes, you know, between a parent and a child, it'd be an agreement that's understood by the reality of how a family functions. But God gave an agreement to the people of Israel. People of Israel said yes. And then, you know, life is not always this all fun and games and joy and so on. You have obligations. This is the maturity you have to grow in. Okay, when you are a kid, when you're 5 years old, and you steal candy from a store, people don't want to really get upset with you. When you do it when you're 10 years old, then your parents are going to get very angry. When you do it when you're 15 years old, you're a criminal.
Right.
And this is the thing that goes on in here. Israel is being told off more and more and more, to the point you've been a kingdom for a very long time, for hundreds of years. You've grown and so on, and you're still making the same mistakes. And now I have to punish you like a criminal.
Yeah, you have to wonder, does the child ever really believe it when his parent says that this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you? You know, and God is saying, you know, he's saying the same thing. This is hurting me to do this. You know, this is affecting me to do this. And, you know, does the kid ever really believe it when the parent says, you know, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you? So I don't know that Israel ever really understood that.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about when I have to deal with a child, you know, we as humans, we lose our temper. And the question is God are we and God exactly the same? Do we respond and react to things the same way God does? That's an interesting debate that actually we're dealing with in a course I was taking. We were speaking about God in the book of Genesis, and sometimes he is depicted as if he's very emotional and can respond violently like a regular human being. But then on the other hand, you know, maybe we're just depicting him as to resemble us because we don't really have any other way of really describing any of this. But does the child understand the difficulty? I think that we have to understand that God does speak to the people of Israel with love, with care, and with compassion, with wanting to do good with his people, to give to them everything that he can. And you know, because of the perspective that probably a lot of people picked up from the ancient Near East, where the gods were violent and difficult and so on, and they probably lost that point. This is why the prophet also has to point this out here, that God has difficulty and he's crying from the inside. He doesn't want to do this, but he has to, because he's also a God of judgment.
Okay, Yoel. So basically, kind of closing out today's discussion, the prophets and Leviticus 26 all rolled into one. Let's go ahead and close it out with the end of Leviticus 26. And it says, "And yes, even then, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them." Yeah?
No, before we do that, there's an interesting verse here in Oshea, something very beautiful in verse 10. In the Hebrew text, it's verse 10. It says that they will. It says, "Acharei Adonai yelechu ke'arei Yishag, ki hu Yishag ve'yachedu vanim miyam." They will follow God like, and He will roar like a lion. When a lion roars, it's supposed to be like very loud noise and so on, and they will quiver from the ends of the earth, of the ends of the sea, and they will return. There will be a point there that, as if God Himself would roar out like the king of all animals. Though lions are pretty lazy animals, but the majestic side of the lion, and will actually be called back home. With all this, these bad things that he said that are going to happen, and all this exile and so on, he's actually going at one point to roar and to bring roar out with a loud voice to bring them back to their land. And this actually ties up to the verse you're about to read. So now you have permission to go to that verse.
Beautiful. So he goes back to Leviticus 26, which again is echoed in Deuteronomy 30, 2 Chronicles 7, if my people will call by my name. And yes, even then, Leviticus 26, 44, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, I will not repel them to finish them off, to abrogate my covenant with them, he will not do, for I, Yehovah, am their God. And this is after they're cut off. This is during the time of cut off. He says, I, Yehovah, am their God, and I will bear in mind to their benefit the covenant of the former ones whom I brought out of the land of Egypt before the eyes of the nations to be for them a God. I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah. These are the laws, the regulations, and instructions that Yehovah gave between himself and the children of Israel at Mount Sinai by the hand of Moshe. This is just super, super powerful to me. He mentions here the covenant, when the covenant was given. This is Mount Sinai. Then he repeats it again, that these are the laws and the regulations and the instructions that God gave between himself and the children of Israel. Not his children, the children of Israel. He brought a nation out and made himself the God of this nation and those who submit to themselves to the covenant. That there is a promise, a restoration, that even in the midst of them being sent off into the land of their enemies, into the four corners of the earth, as it says in other places, that he will remember those of the covenant and shall bring them back. This is a promise. I think that we need to be shouting from the rooftops.
Mm-hmm. This is actually a very, very beautiful verse. I mean, I'm compelled to read in Hebrew, so here we go.
Please.
So he says here, Ve'af gam zot bihotam be'eretz oyvehem, lo me'astim ve'lo ge'altim l'chalotam, le'afer b'riti itam ki ani Adonai Elohim. This is one of the really pivotal points, that he's not going to undo the covenant. Though he sent them out, he's not undoing the covenant. Ve'zacharti lahem b'rit rishonim, אשר הוצאתי אותם מארץ מצרים לעיני הגויים להיות להם לאלוהים אני אדוני. The words you are not chosen for no reason, he says, that, you know, I remember the covenant of the first ones when they came out of Egypt. But he points out, before the eyes of the nations, you know, he's saying, whatever the nations might think about Israel, boo-hoo, it's not true. I will bring them out before the eyes of all the nations to show the nations that I've not abandoned my people. I am a God of faith. I gave them a covenant, and I will stand behind that covenant and keep that covenant.
Amen.
And no matter what someone would say about the nations, from the nations about his people, he made a promise. That's it.
Which in my head keeps going back to Isaiah 52 and 53, that these nations, the eyes of the nations, God is going to do this before the eyes of the nations. And other prophets, it says that I will do these things so that all the nations round about shall know that I am the Lord your God. And you know, that we look at Isaiah 52 and 53, it says, we beat these people, we cursed these people, we did everything we could to these people, yet God chose them and lifted them up and exalted them amongst the nations. This is, you know, it all fits together. It's all just one babushka.
How do you pronounce babushka?
Well, that's my southern babushka. The nesting dolls, for those who don't know. I had to learn it was babushka today from Yoel.
We actually had one when I was a child. We had one on the set on the television. We used to have one of these old-style televisions with a big box and so on. We had one on top.
Well, you know, so Yoel, all of this fits within the context of restoration back to Eden, and we've talked about that today. The idea that that in the later days, whenever those later days are, if it's our time or sometime in the future, we just don't know until it starts to happen. That a large group, a number, not just a single prophet as it was in the days of the past, but a number of people will all stand up, which I think in itself will be a sign, because, hey, you get a whole bunch of folks that stand up and want to say that God spoke to them, they're going to have all different messages across the board. But when all these people, all these children of our fathers stand up, they're all going to be saying the same thing. It's going to be in itself a sign. And, you know, that's going to be bringing back the inheritance and bringing the people of the inheritance back. And it's a promise. Just like we can look at the promises that brought about curses, we can also have just as much faith in the promises that are supposed to bring blessings. So I think this is a wonderful discussion that we had today, Yoel. Is there a way that you kind of want to wrap it up into a single, you know, blurb, that an elevator pitch, as it were, to help people kind of remember everything that we said?
I will tell an interesting story here. When, before the creation of the State of Israel, there was a debate what the anthem would be. And someone, I don't remember all the details because I learned this stuff a very long time ago in high school, someone suggested that Psalm 126 will actually be the anthem. And I think that, you know, the second verse in the Psalm, it says, "Az emalese chokpinu l'shonenu rina." Then our mouth will be filled with laughter and our tongues with praise. "Az yomru v'goyim." Then they will say in the nations, "Higdila Adonai la'asot imenu." The Lord has done greatness for these people.
Mm.
And that's kind of like the song of redemption that we see at the end here of the parasha, and what we also see here at the end of the chapter in Hosea. The point where God would do all these things in front of the nations, he would roar to everyone, that they will quiver at the other end of the sea. At the other end, is basically, he says, the sea, it's really the Mediterranean, all the way to the end of that, of the world, the known world of the time. That also means that everyone on the path of that world will hear this roar. And it will be done in front of all the nations. And I think that's really the message that we need to take from these two readings that we did today, this combined recording, that at the end, it's all going to revert back to its original reality.
I'd like you to close everything out today with that in Hebrew. Would you do that for us?
So the Hebrew reads, "Shir ha-ma'alot b'shuv Adonai et shivat Zion, ha'inu ke'cholmim. Az yimmaleh se'chokpinu l'shonenu rina, az yomru v'goyim, higdil Adonai la'asot im ele. Higdil Adonai la'asot imanu, ha'inu semechim. Shuvah Adonai et shivitenu, ka'afikim b'negev. Hazor'im b'dim'a b'rina yikzoru. Haloch yelech uvacho nose meshech hazara.
Shalom, everybody. You guys be blessed. We'll talk to you soon.
Kol tov.
Talking Torah.